been a member since the mid to late 90s when, as a my former life, I am a soil scientist and was a professor at University of Wisconsin-Madison. And I thought that PFI was so innovative and so cool that I wanted to be a member. And my husband Wes and I have been co-members for over a decade as well. So it's really an honor to be here and to talk about what we've achieved over a little over a decade of being in the dairy business. Just to get a sense of who all is here, how many of you have goats? Okay, how many of you want to have goats? And how many of you have dairy experience? All right, quite a few. And anybody cheesemaker? Great. All right, well, we are going to, my husband and I are going to do a little bit of tag teaming here to present. We have three topics or three stages of how we're going to present to you this morning or this afternoon. The first is just a general overview of our farm and what we do and how we got started and a little bit of the economics of it all and where we see ourselves going in the future. And then the second presentation is focused on our farm kitchen and our forays into agritourism. And then the last presentation is about our markets and our marketing strategies and how those have evolved over time. Followed by the tasting. So we're gonna hold you to the end before you get the reward. All right, so our current farm enterprises, and it's helpful to think of our farm as a suite of enterprises. We were in denial about that for quite some time, but we actually accept that we have multiple enterprises on our farm. The dairy and the creamery are that entity is by far the largest resource commitment and revenue stream for the farm. The organic orchard, our farm kitchen, and agritourism, and what we call farm education. And you can see the timelines of when these various enterprises came online. The orchard was first, and we purchased our farm in 2003, we had moved from Madison, Wisconsin to Champaign-Urbana because Wes, who's also a soil scientist, was offered a position at the University of Illinois in Champaign-Urbana. And so in order for me to leave Madison, we had to find a farm. And we both wanted to farm. We both wanted to have a small, diverse farm that we could put into play a lot of the ideas that we were telling other people they should do as it relates to sustainable agriculture. I didn't grow up on a farm. I grew up in Boston, Massachusetts, in a very, very urban setting. And yet I worked with farmers for over 15 years and was telling them what to do, but I'd never actually tried to do it myself. Wes, on the other hand, grew up on a small, diverse farm in Oregon, west of Portland, where the primary enterprise was fruit, because that's what you grow in that area. It's incredible mecca for fruit. And he wanted to grow fruit organically so that we could have people come out and experience the incredible joy of eating dead, ripe fruit that's totally safe for people to eat. So we purchased a property that is less than 4 miles from downtown Champaign and Urbana. And we purchased our home, a Morton building, and a total of about 7 acres. And this piece of ground was carved off of what had been a cash grain agriculture enterprise, a 40-acre piece. Our first line of business that first season was to put all of the tillable acres in cover crop. Even though our soils are the most beautiful prairie soils, decades of essentially monocropping, corn-soybean rotation had really resulted in very poor quality of the soil. So we started to build the quality of the soil by planting a cover crop, and then the following year we planted almost 3 acres of tree fruits and berries. We had peaches, apples, pears, cherries, blackberries, raspberries, gooseberries, currants, jostaberries. We even tried a little bit of strawberries. And then that same year, 2004, we purchased some goats. So the goat story is that when we were living in Madison, we would attend the Saturday Farmers Market in downtown Madison, the Dane County Farmers Market, religiously every Saturday, and had become fans of one of the pioneers of artisan French-style goat cheese production in the United States, a woman named Ann Topham of Phantom Farm. She started making beautiful, delicate goat cheeses at a time when people in the United States didn't even know you could milk goats, let alone make cheese. We didn't really even appreciate the incredible knowledge that was in our midst when we were living in Madison. But as we were kind of exiting and I started thinking about cheese making and particular goat cheese making, she became a mentor and a really great resource for us. So we got four goats. They were Nubians, 3 does and a buck. And a year later, we're building a commercial dairy and creamery. A year later, yeah. Fast learning curve. We actually became the first in the state of Illinois. It really seemed incredulous to us that there hadn't been a farmstead creamery in the state of Illinois prior to us doing it, at least legally. That had a set of challenges unto itself that I'll talk about in a minute. As time went on, we kept expanding the number of does that were milking. We did a major expansion in 2008 and went from a bucket milking system to a pipeline system. We put in our commercial kitchen. We had a friend purchase 15 acres adjacent to our 7, to the east of our 7 acres, so that we were able to manage a total of 22 acres. We also the following year started working with an Amish family to help them become licensed as the first and only sheep dairy in the state of Illinois, and purchased pretty much all of their milk for 4 years and turned it all into cheeses. That relationship ended in beginning of our 2014 season. I'll talk about that in a minute. We expanded our herd of milking does, we had, because goats are seasonal, or at least the way that we breed them, they're essentially all on the same lactation schedule from early March through early December. When they are in peak production, we found, especially with the sheep milk and turning that into cheese, that our capacity to make cheese was reaching its limit with our facility. So we decided that we would add another value-added product that was in compliance with our permit as a manufactured milk processing facility, and that was gelato. So we went to Italy, because why not? and took a week-long short course on gelato in Bologna, Italy, and came back and launched a new product line. And that was really a great experience. And the product, we didn't bring that for logistical reasons, but if you come to Champagne, we'll give you some gelato. Since 2012, we've done more and more in the realm of agritourism. Our proximity to town meant that people just drove in the driveway constantly and just kind of wanted a tour or wanted to walk around. And we just, instead of continuously saying to people, no, we're a working farm, we're busy, we decided we've got to take control of this situation and do tours on our own terms. So, and charge people for it because it was our time. We've done tours. We've started to do some classes. The farm to table experience are definitely a form of agritourism, and we've just become more conscious of the role that plays in the overall marketing of our other products. All right, so one of the first pieces of advice from Ann Topham of Phantom Farm to me was, well, she asked, why do you want to do this? She was extremely skeptical, which was good. It was good to have a devil's advocate. And then she said, have you ever raised any livestock? I said, no. And she said, how do you even know that you're going to like goats? So I said, well, I don't know. And she said, well, just get some. Get a few and see if you like them. So I did my research. I was really wanting to find the breed or breeds that would have high quality milk for cheese making. And for those of you who are in the dairy goat world, I was fortunate to meet with the late Harvey Considine and pick his brain, and he was the founder of dairy goat judging and all this. And he gave me some names of potential herds to buy from, and we purchased our first three does and a buck, all yearlings, never been bred before, in the late spring of 2004. They came from Kansas. And not knowing anything about their life cycle and not knowing, I had bought all the books, Dairy Goat Keeping 101, Stories Guide to Dairy Goats, etc. Everything was emphasizing seasonal breeding, that their heat cycle is cued by day length, that they wouldn't start coming into heat until the fall. So we set up a pen with the buck and the does all together because it was June, and I thought we had a couple months, you know, before we had to worry about anything. Lois is laughing. we just kind of, you know, we both had off-farm jobs full-time and went about our way, and Thanksgiving rolled around, and let me back up. So October was, you know, okay, the plan was breed in October, kid in March, 5 month gestation. August, we start seeing the buck going after one of our does, or our neighbor's kid actually saw that the buck going after one of the does. So we immediately separated them. That was in August. And then I started noticing two of them were getting fat, and being a scientist, I was, all right, we got to rule out that there wasn't some accidental hanky-panky. So I actually had the vet come out and ultrasound them to make sure that there wasn't any babies growing in there. And they didn't see anything, so they said, oh, you're fine. And so we thought, okay, great, we dodged the bullet. We didn't see actual breeding. We didn't really even know what we were looking for, like what the signs are, which is so amazing that we didn't. That's how our level of ignorance was, or at least mine. Then November rolls around, and my level of ignorance of what are the telltale signs that happen to a yearling just prior to kidding, well, their udder drops. I thought, oh, they're getting little udders, how cute. And then the Monday after Thanksgiving, we come home from work, and I go out to feed them, and I hear the cry of a what sounded like an infant. And I was in complete denial. I didn't even want to look in the direction of where that sound was coming from. But after a while, I couldn't deny it anymore. And there was a little buckling on the ground. Chocolate, one of our three yearlings, had kitted. 2 weeks later, her sister Snickerdoodle kitted with twins. And so began our odyssey in winter milking in a unheated dirt floor, on a wooden milk stand, which Wes was convinced was going to be the end of the dairy goat experiment. But we milked them, we made cheese in the house, we tried it out on friends, and they thought it was decent. And then we decided, all right, well, what do we need to do to make a saleable product? This was the other piece of advice that she gave us, was find a breeder who's breeding for production. Well, in 2003, 2004, that was pretty hard to find. Pretty much any stock that you were looking at that was considered quality stock was coming out of the show world. So we tried our best. We tried to explain our motives to a breeder. And she did our foundation genetics in terms of components was incredible. So this was our original setup. There's the barn with the little milking stand, and we just built a little shed off the pole barn, and that's where up to 40 goats lived in that little shed. And they had access to about 2 acres of pasture. Once we decided to go commercial, we had to ask ourselves, we also wrote a business plan, so we really had to ask ourselves these questions of what did we want to be and what didn't we want to be? Did we want to just maintain a small herd and just make a small amount of cheese? Did we want to become a large dairy and sell our milk to another entity to make cheese, which in central Illinois was a non-starter because there weren't any creameries in our area that we could even consider selling to. How many does do you want to be milking? How much land do we have to sustain them in a way that was in line with our values of trying to be a pasture-based dairy? And a number of cheesemakers who I had talked with in doing my research said, oh, they don't really want to have anything to do with the husbandry, just give me the milk. I want to be a cheesemaker. And I was really torn because I was really interested in the husbandry as well as the cheesemaking part of it. And farm cheese production was really what we wanted to do. And how many products? How many styles of cheese? And where were we going to market these products? And who was even going to buy them? And how much should we charge? All of those things were really important. Doing a little bit of market research was really important. Who would buy them? Where, if we sold these at farmers markets, what would the clientele be like? Would stores buy our product? Stores in our community of Champaign-Urbana, but what about Chicago? Chicago's only 2 hours north of us. We also needed to figure out how much we were going to charge. And we knew that the market probably would only bear so much in terms of what we could charge. But we also knew that we thought we had a superior product than commercial, large-scale commercial goat cheese. We also just asked other artisan cheesemakers what they were charging, and the cheesemaker community is pretty convivial, I would say. Lois can interject. and then as far as the fruit goes, because we were really not too many organic fruit growers in the Midwest, we knew that we couldn't really charge much of a premium on our organic fruit, especially since it wasn't very beautiful. Tasted great. the regulatory aspect of it was a huge learning curve for both us and the regulator. The regulator attitude at that time was there's no way that you could safely have a dairy and a creamery physically located in the same spot, and in our case, in the same building. And we had to do a really good job of convincing them that we could do this safely and make products that wouldn't kill people or make them really sick. But we did, obviously, we overcame their perceptions about how this could or couldn't be done. It was key for us to develop a good working relationship with the regulator from day one. All regulators, I don't care what state you're in, what county, whatever, they hate surprises. It's not the do it and then ask for forgiveness approach. They really don't work well in that kind of set of parameters. So giving them your ideas when they are just ideas really helped us win them over. Also, the fact that we're both scientists and we could kind of come up with well-reasoned science-based arguments for some of our decisions, especially as it relates to raw milk cheese, which we're totally afraid of. That really helped. But being on a good footing with the regulators was essential to helping us get properly inspected and approved. We had a series of four inspections prior to our actual license being granted, and it was a very rigorous process, and our equipment inspector was extremely skeptical that the equipment that we had purchased, imported from the Netherlands, was going to be safe. We overcame all that. We finalized our business plan. We got a loan based on the assumptions in our business plan about what it would cost to build the creamery, and we submitted the plans, and then we started to get bids from respective contractors after we found out from the Department of Public Health that we couldn't do a lot of the work ourselves. We had to have certified licensed tradespeople, the plumbing, the electrical, the HVAC, and things like that. And when those quotes started coming back in, we realized that our estimates were woefully inadequate, and then we just started liquidating assets to be able to pay, because we already had launched ourselves down that road, and we were just determined we were going to do this. So that's what we did, and we didn't lose the off-farm jobs. Very important. Okay, I'm going to turn it over to Wes now. How are we doing? Behind.
Well, like I said, just store up your questions, except for anything confusing about what we're saying at the moment. But that's really a pleasure to be here. Like Leslie said, I think since I moved to Wisconsin about 15 years ago, I've been a member of PFI as well. Never lived here, but. I'll use it. We were both academics for a long time, so. Okay, I don't have to move too much. No, I got it. Okay. Oh, there'll be a short moment for equipment. So like Leslie said, I grew up on a small farm in Western Oregon. We did everything ourselves. We didn't call in licensed contractors for anything. So I thought, well, we can figure this out. It can't be that hard. And then we found out we had to. There wasn't any choice, and we had to show the regulators who we brought in and what they were doing. We could build walls, we could do floors, some other stuff, but the critical, most health-related parts of it, we needed to bring people in, too. So we decided that we'd be grade B milk, manufactured milk, not grade A to begin with. Thought that would be a little simpler. Turns out it's not much harder to become grade A, and we really did most of what we needed to be grade A.
Oops.
Oh, are you going to advance? Sorry.
I'll advance. Oh. You relax.
Okay.
let me see. All right. We thought we'd get certified by June. It turned out that with our three additional, the bathroom wasn't right. There had to be a bathroom. The office wasn't right. That had to be corrected. They found a crack or two in equipment that they argued about for a while. But anyway, finally, after dumping 2 months' worth of milk, we were able to get licensed. This is what the floor plan looked like when we started. it was a big building. The farmer used it to park his corn and bean equipment. Two big sliding doors on each side and a dirt floor. So we this was the plan that we sent to the Department of Public Health. There is the short version is that there was a holding pen here. There was an up ramp and a down ramp, and a milking parlor stand. Milk house with a bulk tank, kind of a boiler room in this area, bathroom, and then this was the creamery, the make room, where we were going to put it together, three compartment sink here, et cetera, et cetera. We got pretty close, so here's the final. And then this wasn't finished at all. We didn't have any plans for that. We had mostly hay in there. We kept the animals in there part of the time, still dirt floored. And so this is what freaked them out, in part, because we had, there was actual manure that came in here to the milk stand, and we're only like three doors away, and there's, we're making cheese. So they calmed down after a while. We tried not to say that, yeah, you know, over in Wisconsin, they've been doing this for a long time. Don't ever compare it to another state. They don't like that at all, because those other states are all lax, it turns out, and that they sometimes don't, as we know, Wisconsin doesn't know much about milk, just like the Netherlands don't know much about milk. So anyway, we bit our tongue till it was hamburger and made it through. And they've gotten really, like Leslie says, they've actually become very good friends, and they put us up as models now and refer a lot of people to us, but it you just got to stay calm. This is what it looks like now. So back to this area. This is all that's left of our inside holding pen. We keep the animals outside a little bit here. There's a big hoop barn here and a big hoop barn there now that the animals are in. This is where the dough, the milking doughs are primarily. Doesn't work on both of them, but. So that's the holding pen, and the two barns the animals are kept in are over here. There's a cement pad that they hang out in on the way into the milking parlor. Milking parlor's doubled in size. This is another thing that we got lucky with in a way. We decided that we just needed a seven stanchion setup to begin with. We went up to Wisconsin, bought one from a guy, a small dairy goat cheesemaker. And brought it down. We decided we needed more goats. We decided to expand. We doubled the size. And so we were able to knock out one wall and increase the size of the milking parlor quite a bit. The milk comes out of the pipe, and then we put in a pipeline system in 2008. That was a big year for us. So we'd been milking with a bucket. You'll see in a minute. And the pipeline runs along here into the milk house. We have two bulk tanks there, and then there's a pipeline that goes over through the office and drops on into the pasteurizer vats. So the milk line runs up through there into the milk house, and then we have another pipeline that drops it over into the creamery. So our milk travels about 40 feet in stainless steel from the time it comes out of the goat till it's made into milk. That's what we tell people, and that with goat milk in particular, we're told, and we think it's pretty true, that it's more delicate than cow's milk, that the less shaking it gets, it's got to stay clean and it's got to get cold fast. And so with this kind of system, we did quite a good job with the bucket milker too, and you can definitely do a good job with a bucket milker. You just got to be really, really careful and make sure whoever's using it knows exactly what they're doing, so they don't accidentally contaminate it. So right now we have the flashed forward. So I do both sides. So it goes from the creamery. So we have the creamery here now. We added the aging rooms later. We had a walk-in cooler we bought from Kmart when it closed in town. In 2008, we put in our commercial kitchen. We're going to talk a lot about that later. And a couple years later, we actually closed this in, put a loft in the whole thing, this whole side, and we were able to store hay up there now. And this has become our dining room and classroom where we teach beginning farmer courses. This is all that's left of my shop, and it's mostly storage. So that's if I get my wish at someday, that would be another thing, would be to have a decent place to work on stuff, but especially in this weather. But for now, that's the way it pans out. So while we got this up, are there any questions about that part of it? I'd be happy to answer any later. Yes. Yeah, the aging rooms are just.
Actually, we're gonna show pictures of them. Yes.
Yeah, show pictures, but they're just 8x8x8 cubes. So we used 4x8 insulated FRP panels to make them, and they're 8x8x8, and we cool them with to maintain the temperature with a system called a valence system, which is a cold water ethylene glycol based system that allows you to keep it more humid, doesn't take the humidity out of the air like an air conditioner or a cool bot does typically. So, yes? That's just where they, kind of the staging ground where the goats hang out before they go into the milking parlor. And they walk up a ramp on that leads through the wall into onto the stand. This is the before the construction. Could go into a lot of detail. Our friend, he was a master's student at the U of I, decided he'd rather go straight into farming, Eric Menzel. And he is now farming in Solon, Iowa, and he's from Waterloo originally. And he's got a nice little restaurant. He's a really good cook. He's got a great restaurant, Salt Fork Kitchen, in downtown Solon. So that's a little plug for him. He uses a lot of local products, raises quite a bit himself, and brings it in from others. So he's a good carpenter, too. So he helped us and a couple other people with that. And again, they didn't have to be licensed for that kind of work. This is the original parlor, really nice stainless steel-based stanchion. This Swiss cheesemaker made, and that's the bucket milker, of course. And we just, when we got enough milk in it, I'd walk into the milk house and pour it through a filter into the bulk tank. The bulk tanks were, we were lucky. Ann helped us. She had an old one in the back of her barn. A neighbor had an old one in the back of her barn. And so we were able to get those. In those days, it was really hard to find an 80 to 100 gallon bulk tank, really hard. And because they were way too small for cow dairies, they'd been disposed of. But now there's some small equipment makers that are starting to make some, I think, pretty good ones. And so it's not like it was at that point. Ours still work fine. We've had a little bit of work with the compressor and other things, but the stainless, if you don't really abuse it, stainless lasts a long time. And it's a lot cheaper when it's used, like this tank, like that sink. And those are the bulk tanks, around 100 gallon and a rectangular 80 gallon. And this was the creamery when we started, pretty bare bones, three compartment sink, that one pasteurizer. We, after our numbers went up a little bit, we did buy a second pasteurizer. These are fantastic. They're 52-gallon pasteurizers made in the Netherlands. Again, at that time, we were having a dickens of a time finding used. We were looking for used small ones, and they just didn't exist. And when they did, they were just maybe 80% the price of a brand new one. So we just bit the bullet and bought a new one. And we ended up buying a second new one, too, because they really have done a good job. I do most of the, we've never had, actually Harold's never come out, I don't think. So I've been able to do all the repairs and fixes myself on it so far, knock on wood. We'll see what happens next week, but anyway, so far so good. But they're really well made, and the Dutch do know a lot about milk, it turns out. So, and this is the way it looks now, a lot more crowded. I think that this is Chev draining, isn't it?
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure. So it's a 52-gallon container, so about 400 pounds of milk go in at a time. And it's a cheese vat. We only pasteurize at 145 for 30 minutes. So it's a low temperature, long time pasteurization. We think that's awfully good for goat's milk too. We do make, well, you're going to talk probably about that too, but one of our vat, we use a boiler now to heat the water that goes through the jacket. We initially bought, our first one had electric heater built into it, and that'll add up after a while with cost. We were lucky to be on a natural gas line, along with being pretty close to town. That was really lucky. So we have natural gas, and that's what we use to heat the boiler. And we do use the electric assist when we want to go up to 185 to make something, ricotta in particular. But the boiler is a great thing, and I think we'll be using it for some other applications down the line. We put a window in there, which everybody likes a lot, and we use that to show people, let people look into it too. We're hypersensitive about visitors, and so we make it clear that they can look through the window, but except with a few exceptions, they don't come into the creamery at all. And this is two of our workers who now live in Kansas and are working on starting their own system like ours. Now we have two of the vats set up. They work really well together. Packaging area. I think it's time for me to turn it over to Leslie. So do you want to use this?
So as we expanded the repertoire of cheeses, we started with just Chev, just a fresh goat cheese, and in that first year, and by the second year, we were expanding into the realm of bloomy rind or soft ripened cheeses, going at the end of that second year, going into our third year, we expanded our repertoire to raw milk cheeses, harder raw milk cheeses. For those of you that are not familiar with the rule, the FDA rule on raw milk cheese is it has to be 60 days aged or longer to be made from raw or unpasteurized milk. So as we expanded the repertoire of cheeses, we needed aging rooms that we could hold to specific temperature and humidity regimes for the different styles of cheese. That's when we initially built four aging rooms. And one of those served as a drying room, but then we purchased a clean out of place or COP wash tank in 2011 or 10, which took up in a pretty good footprint in the make room. We decided to create its own room because the noise when that thing was running was deafening and was definitely going to result in deaf workers pretty short order. So we enclosed it and lost one of our aging rooms. So we now have three aging rooms, and we have a little cubby that is just dairy board, and we just kind of move a portable air conditioner in front of that and the stack of cheeses towards the back. So there's not cold air blowing on those cheeses, and the function of the air conditioner is more to
take moisture out of the room than it is to keep it cold. But that we try to keep it at about 60 degrees. And this is strictly for Bloomy Rind cheeses only, to remove the surface moisture before they go into a high humidity environment. our aging rooms, we have a room that is exclusively for what are called Penicillium candidum or P. candidum rinded cheeses, because that white mold is very sensitive to other rogue molds, and you can get contamination on your white, beautiful white rind. We have a separate room for our raw milk cheeses. We actually make a blue cheese, and it has cohabited with another raw milk cheese that we make that is in the style of a tome, T-O-M-M-E. All of our sheep milk and goat milk cheeses were being aged, the raw milk ones, in that same space for quite some time. And then we now have a separate room for another style of Bloomy Rind cheese that has an even more sensitive and more delicate white mold, Geotrichum candidum, that's highly, can be contaminated by the Penicillium candidum, so they can't cohabit. So when you get into making a variety of styles of cheese, how they're aged and who they cohabit with is very important to take into consideration. Okay, just a little bit about, you look at how we've grown in a meteoric sense, and we initially, our business plan was designed for us to be profitable milking no more than 40 goats, and that was based on our initial assumptions about how much our infrastructure was going to cost, which, as I mentioned, or maybe I didn't mention, it ended up costing us three times what our original estimate was to construct our facility. And that set us on, as I was describing to Lois, a treadmill of we had to get bigger to be able to pay for the infrastructure that we had implemented. And also, we had put in infrastructure that wasn't being utilized to its full capacity. So we thought we needed to expand the herd, have more milk, to not only increase our revenue stream, but also utilize the resources that we had built to a more effective way. So our actual projections, that big pivotal year was 2008. That was going into our fourth year as a creamery. And we've gradually expanded to 70 plus. This year we're actually going to be freshening about 80 does, and 20 of those are yearlings. So we'll probably have an increase in milk production over last year. Okay, so we. Because of our need to generate more revenue, and we had to get an additional loan. This friend of ours purchased this additional acreage. We bought that second vat. All of those things were with the idea of increasing our revenue stream. I'm going to talk more about the kitchen and such and why that factored in. That space that was originally where the kitchen is now was destined to be an on-farm shop, but we decided to put in a kitchen on-farm market. So we added these enterprises as a way to generate more revenue, and that was motivated by having to take on more debt to grow faster. The same with adding another kind of milk. We didn't want sheep. Definitely did not want. I don't want to offend anybody who's thinking of sheep dairy, but once you've had goats, sheep are not as interesting. Their milk is incredible, though, for cheese making. Amazing, very high solids, beautiful, fun milk to work with. So definitely was really wanting to make cheese with that milk, but did want to have the sheep. And we were bringing in 100 gallons a week from this Amish producer who was milking about 60 ewes. And their lactation is even shorter than than goats. It's about a 6 to 7 month lactation. As I mentioned earlier, the gelato expanding into frozen desserts, milk-based desserts, was a way to deal with the hyper-seasonal seasonal surplus of milk in the spring and summer. And that also enabled us to add even more than 50 goats to the herd because we had another outlet for the milk in gelato. So where do we stand today? We're milking between 70 and 80. We have a standing herd of close to 100 animals. That includes our retirees, our breeding males, and our young of the year. We retain anywhere from a dozen to 25 dolings every year as replacements. We're producing about 14 to 15,000 pounds of cheese a year. Most of that is sold within the state of Illinois, probably 95 to 98% of it. We make about a little over 3,000 pints of gelato every year. We're a seasonal dairy, we're still seasonal. Although this winter we have started buying some cow milk from another grass-based dairy that bottles their own milk just north of us, and we're experimenting with some cow milk cheese that I've brought for you guys to taste. And that also factors into the cash flow issue. We continue to maintain our land organic. We were certified up through 2010, and we dropped our certification. We can tell you why later. We sell about half of what we produce direct to consumers through farmers markets, on-farm sales, and we also do a CSA. And then the other half is sold wholesale, direct wholesale to cheese shops, local independent grocery stores, restaurants. We used to have a distributor in Chicago. We don't anymore. I would say about 25-30% of our income is coming from food-related events, classes, workshops, and education tours and things like that. Okay, as far as challenges, we moved from, the Dairyland, the United States Dairyland, that is Wisconsin, to what we call a dairy desert in central Illinois. There had been small dairies back in the 30s up through the late 70s, early 80s, but we're currently, aside from the University of Illinois's dairy, we're the only commercial dairy in our county, which is kind of astounding. When we started, we had no fellow cheesemakers, let alone even dairy people. There were no suppliers of chemicals and infrastructure and that kind of technical support. We had to go to Wisconsin to get that kind of support. So it was kind of lonely for a while, not having people to talk to and people that actually understood what it was that we were trying to do. We were even initially going to run it organically, the dairy, and we had to back off of that pretty quickly. The capital costs were way more than what we had anticipated, and just understanding the regulations, they don't make it easy. They don't want you to have it be easy because they perceive that what you want to do with on-farm creamery could be potentially harmful to people. That's their initial mindset, or at least it was at the time. And we are held to the same regulatory standards as Kraft. It's just that we're smaller scale and our economy of scale is not Kraft. But it's not all negative. It's really great. We have a unique enterprise in our region. Our customer base has grown with us as we've diversified our product line. We have an incredible community because it's a university town. People have traveled all over the world. Chicago really is our backyard, and They're hungry for artisan cheeses. We're in a really good location for the kind of products that we produce. And our proximity to town and our transparency of how we do things makes it so that people like coming out to our farm and interacting with our animals and just having an experience that they really have no other place to go to that's close by that is welcoming to customers. We can do whatever we want in so many ways. We're obviously limited by resources, and one of those is time and age. Okay. All right. The money part of it. You want to come back up and talk about the money and how are we on time? Oh, okay. We're good. Okay, good.
I think we're good.